Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Happy birthday, William Shakespeare. Today is the day. Today is William Shakespeare's, some people think, birthday. Although that's not for sure, actually. But what we do know is today is William Shakespeare's death day. So we can say happy death day. Today, Miguel de Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote, also died. In fact, they died on the same day of the same year, the 23rd of April, 1616. And because you're considered such great authors, this is considered the day of literature. And Dean and I, we thought that we'd briefly explain to you why Shakespeare is such a great author, why he's so timeless, why he's so relevant, and simply why he's such an enjoyable read. And Dean, we've been reading Shakespeare the whole month, rereading and reading some, in my case, reading some plays I haven't read before. How was your experience for the whole month of Shakespeare?
No, it was really good. I mean, we're in the fortunate position that we're picking the ones we want to start with. So we're doing our favorites first, but we've done five and we're working on a sixth, and it's very, very enjoyable. I'll tell you one thing. I read these first a couple of years ago, and I find at the time, you know, the language is quite tricky and things like that. But on the second read through, I'm finding it a lot more straightforward, a lot easier to grasp.
Yeah. Well, look, I've got to say the same thing I want to say. I think the first play I ever read fully was the Scottish play. Mm-hmm. So Macbeth. Oh, should I be saying that word? And I really was struggling through it. And I enjoyed it at the end a bit, but I felt like that was very difficult. But then a few years later, I did read maybe five or six plays on one go. And I just automatically, it was a lot easier for me. And I think it was A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's the second one I read fully and just really enjoyed it. And recently again, now then back to it, now I find it quite easy. I have to say, I'm not having difficulties. Now, I do love languages, and it helps when you kind of love languages and understand language. If you understand Latin, German, it's old English. But if you get the annotated, I would recommend you start with an annotated version. And he would probably have to learn a tiny bit of the grammar, understand that thy means your, or that thou is the colloquial version of you. Mm-hmm. It comes from German, by the way. So if you know German,
maybe thou I'm comes just from assuming that everyone knows that, but like, I don't know, these millennials don't even know what books are. So I guess they don't know what thy means.
So guys, well, look, this is time for you to refresh thy old English. And basically, if you go beyond the language, it's not too difficult. You will really enjoy these stories because they're timeless. They're really timeless. I feel like this could have been written when I read Macbeth, even though I found it difficult, I felt that play could have been written yesterday. That's how modern. In fact, it also was really, really violent and vicious. And I just thought, all right, this could have just been written last year, because it feels also like it could have been controversial. I feel like had Macbeth not been written and were written last year or this year, it would be a controversial play right now.
We have noticed that actually, you know, in a few of the ones we've mentioned while we've been discussing them, that, you know, actually this could have been done as a modern play. You know, it's the themes are real and they're modern and they're still alive. I mean, we just wrapped up our recording of Romeo and Juliet, and those themes of love are still true and still alive. That teen love. But in most of these plays, we've noticed that I think that's the genius of Shakespeare, is that writing something that can sustain for hundreds of years, and you can read it, and once you get past the language, basically, it's a modern play.
Exactly, that's great. And of course, the thing is, Shakespeare wasn't you can't say Shakespeare was an intellectual. He wasn't one of the university playwrights that were kind of in at the time, like Christopher Marlowe, for example, or Robert Greene. Those were kind of like more intellectual, whatever that means, in the sense of they went to universities. They were possibly pretentious. They were more pretentious in their kind of like behavior. William Shakespeare had a just kind of normal upbringing, Latin education. The thing is, when you think he's being very intelligent and kind of like elitist, he's not really being elitist for the time. So I mean, those Greek references, I admit they're hard, even for me. I don't know if I get them. I have to look them up. But at the time, this was kind of like it's kind of your normal education. So you did have some, you did need some education, but basically he's not trying to be too difficult. He's trying to be quite accessible. We're just saying that then, right? There's Romeo and Juliet, they have a prologue explaining the whole play. Sometimes it's oversimplified for modern audiences, even made a bit easier, especially Romeo and Juliet. And basically, you know, all those Henry V and VI, I have no idea who they were, you know, to be honest. But at the time, people really got that, you know, and they
At the
were
time, people
often,
knew them, yeah.
and they were often metaphors for contemporary members of the monarchy family. So I mean, so it's all very kind of it's very relevant at the time. And you might have to look up the references, Greek references, historic references, and the language. But apart from that, there is a very universal claim and universal themes in Shakespeare. Yeah, I mean, and I
I
have to
think that I
say,
think that's one of the reasons we haven't been doing the Henrys really yet is because I mean first of all they're very long, but also they're a little bit less relatable to us now than the other plays are. The romances, the tragedies, the comedies, they're a lot more relatable still.
And histories, the history plays of Shakespeare were early plays. So yeah, so possibly, well, they just aren't as popular nowadays anyway, are they? And that has more to do with the very specific Romeo and Juliet their archetypes. You know, they exist in basically every third Hollywood film that comes out is Romeo and Juliet. It is. And every fifth film that comes out is Hamlet, about a man who's lost his father, and but actually one of his family members killed him, and he's going to seek revenge, but he's hesitating. It's all about hesitation, Hamlet.
Now,
And
hold on,
basically,
hold
yeah.
on, PJ. If every third is Romeo and Juliet and every fifth is Hamlet, does that mean that every 15th is a crossover special?
It's a crossover special, exactly. Yeah, and look, guys, every Shakespeare play has been interpreted so often in many different ways. It's brilliant. And like we were just talking also about the genius, like, you know, the plot devices used and, you know, a comedy of errors, which is all about like, just like, how can this happen? But it somehow did. And it's still more or less realistic up to a point. Some plays, as you like it, they really lose the realism. But in general, like, it's all kind of, you can imagine this really happening. That's what I really like about Shakespeare. It's not, he doesn't use too many fantastic elements. But even if he does use them, it's still kind of like, yeah, I can imagine this happen. This is like a human being would react. At least a human being who's maybe in an extreme situation, like a king, like a person who really wants to be king, like Richard III, but is actually hunchback and not so good looking. Yeah, you can imagine these kind of people existing and doing it. Yeah, actually, one of my favorite plays is Richard III, Dean, but we haven't done that yet. So I'm looking forward to doing it. I find it a very deep kind of play. So I kind of wanted more time and talk about this later.
My
If you're interested,
favorite is the unreleased Henry the Sixth, part 5047, because
well,
I really want to
it's a
know just about
classic.
what he had for dinner that day. You know, I just got to get really, really in depth with Henry the Sixth.
So there you go, guys. There's love. Henry's looking forward to. You're looking forward to meeting you. I think that wraps it up about Shakespeare, guys. Do you want to say, Dean, we've got a little treat
Yeah, so
for
the
our
treat is that we've pre-recorded five and we're working already on a sixth, and there will be more. So as part of our, we've mentioned before, we wanted to do the Bufanda Boys, which is going to be our premium, you know, bonus content that you can get and you can pay for. And the first sub show within the Bufanda Boys is going to be the Playboys, and we've
There you
put
go.
on our pipes and our slippers and our maroon smoking jackets and got some pretty girls and hung around the Playboys mansion, and we've got some plays for you. We've done, as I say, we've got five already done, and we're going to show you the first two right now, and they're going to be released just for this weekend. for free as a
celebrating
a little
Shakespeare's birthday.
As a little teaser and to celebrate Shakespeare's birthday. And then if you like it, from the 1st of May, everything will be launched online on our Patreon. You'll immediately have 5 episodes that you can get. And of course, we'll be working then on more. I think we'll aim to have, you know, at least one extra show per month on there. So it's going to be something that you can subscribe to, and you will get content going forward. Plus, there's other treats. There's higher tiers that you can get, T-shirts and all sorts. So definitely look out. It's going to be patreon.com/booksboys, and that's going to go live from the 1st of May.
So, right, so we're looking forward to your reaction. And also, today is Shakespeare's birthday. It's my birthday
as well.
It's
your birthday. Happy birthday, PJ.
Thank you. And it was your birthday on Tuesday. So
it was indeed. It was indeed.
So you're 3 days older than I am. But as I just said, Shakespeare could have been born a bit earlier than 23rd. So, Dean, your birthday might be Shakespeare's birthday. So
it might
I just want to...
But
you're
so
a bit
might
disappointed.
In that case, so might any other day in April.
Yes, or even March, right?
Or March,
We're keeping... Look, we would like it to be our birthday, Shakespeare's birthday. So we're just going to clutch our straws, right?
We're going to grasp the straws. We're gonna make it how we want it. We're going to do it as we like it, PJ.
Oh, nice one, Dean. I think we should wrap it up because I cannot beat thy wit.
That's us.
So, guys.
You're going to hear the first two, which were, let's tell what they were. The first two were The Tempest, which is the second one, and coming up right now, the very first one, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Classic, guys. So the two fantasy plays of Shakespeare we started off with that. So, hope you enjoyed them. Happy Shakespeare Day!
Welcome to our first mini episode of Play Pals. BJ, what are we doing today?
Today, we're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream, the classic, the one and only, the unique play by William Shakespeare, also known as Billy the Lad.
Billy the Lad, or Guillermo Shakespeare has the...
Guillermo Shakespeare. That's what they call him. Yeah, that's what they call him. So that's
I made a mistake
today.
Here. We're doing A Midsummer Night's Dream. So what this play is going to be, this mini show is going to be basically sort of semi-review, semi-educational kind of play reviews. So we'll start with some Shakespeare's. I got confused, PJ, through the week. I confused A Midsummer Night's Dream with Midsummer Murders. So I watched a lot of episodes of old ladies solving crimes on British television, and then I realized that wasn't the right thing at all. So,
And you're wondering where Shakespeare got all those influences from? Like,
I was
there? Like,
really, really baffled, and then I realized my mistake. So I've gone and I've read this play, A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's one of his shorter plays, to be fair.
It is indeed. It's also one of two plays that have fantasy in them. So Shakespeare doesn't use fantasy in his plays, except in A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest. Mm-hmm. And before we begin actually talking about this play, I want to tell the people that Dean and I, we've had this idea to start off with Shakespeare because 23rd of April is Book Day. And it's also my birthday, actually. So I'm very happy to be born this day because it's the day that Shakespeare died.
PJ, I feel swindled here on Books Boys. You share your birthday with Shakespeare. Do you know who I share my birthday with?
Who do you share your birthday with?
Hitler.
Do you really?
Yes, 20th of April, 3 days before you. I share my birthday with Hitler. You got Shakespeare. You got Shakespeare. I got Hitler. So.
Okay, to be fair, he might... But listen to this. They thought Shakespeare was born on the 23rd. He died on the 23rd, but he was actually baptized on the 23rd of April, which means he might have been born on the 20th of April, Dean.
Okay.
But you might share birthday with... but I share the death day. I don't know how good that is, actually. You might share the birthday.
Grasp at those straws and...
Yeah. So you might share Shakespeare's birthday, but you definitely share Hitler's birthday. So you kind of like... It's a bittersweet life, you know? And basically, we've decided
basically decided to do this because just to celebrate literature, because on that day Hitler, on that day Shakespeare died in 1616, 23rd of April, and so did Miguel de Cervantes, the author of Don Quixote in Spain. So two of the world's most renowned writers died on that very day. And so we're talking about just a handful of Shakespeare plays all through April. And I'm starting off with A Midsummer Night's Dream. So enough rambling. Should I start?
I think you've read it slightly more recently than me, so you can take point.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is. I think I'm also taking the lead because it is among my favorite Shakespeare plays, and it's definitely the Shakespeare play I remember the best from my childhood. So it's the one that they played. I just remember kind of like we were preparing for it, acting in it. So for me, it's a beautiful play. Anyway. Shakespeare didn't write fantasy. He only used fantasy in A Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest. And that's very important because fantasy plays a big role in this play. It's basically about, it's set in Greece, ancient Greece. And it's about four lovers. So that's what they're actually called. They're called four lovers, Hermia, Lysander, Demetrius, and Helena. And basically, there's a bit of dilemma. There's a bit of a dilemma here, as so happens in modern society, Shakespearean society, and ancient Greek society. Sometimes love doesn't work out quite the way expected. So the idea is that Helena is in love with Demetrius, but Demetrius is in love with Hermia. Is it Hermia or Hermia, Dean, actually? I'm getting very confused now.
I've been pronouncing it Hermia, but now that you mention it, I think it is Hermia.
Hermia. So again, Helena is in love with Demetrius, but Demetrius is in love with Hermia, and Hermia is in love with Lysander. Now that's okay because Lysander is in love with Hermia, so that kind of works out. But obviously, Helena is very upset. So it's not a full circle. It's not that everyone loves someone else. It's working out for Hermia and Lysander. All right, so that's fine. However, Hermia's father, Aegeus, is very upset. He doesn't want her to marry Lysander. He wants her to marry Demetrius. And so he goes to the Duke of Athens, Theseus, and talks to him about this. And Theseus agrees Hermia should marry the person her father wants her to marry, Demetrius. It's not working out that way. It's not working out. She wants to escape with Lysander to the outside of Athens where that patriarchal law of Athens does not work anymore, because she wants to get away. She wants to be with Lysander no matter what. She's going to abandon her dad, abandon her Athens, which she describes at one point a heaven, and then now it's a hell. Now it's very important because she has to leave. So they're going to leave. Hermia is going to leave. She's going to meet up with Lysander at midnight, and Helena hears this. They tell her this because she is Hermia's friend. And Helena has a bit of a problem. And this is where it gets interesting. She wants Demetrius to fall in love with her, but Demetrius is in love with Hermia. So her idea is that Demetrius will follow Hermia and Lysander. Demetrius will meet up at the same place where Hermia and Lysander will meet at midnight. Mm-hmm. And Helena is hoping that his heart will break and that Demetrius, will come back to her, because he was also Helena's former lover. If this seems confusing, it is confusing. So that's one of the things I want to talk about this over-romanticization, overdrive. So I just want to stop here a second. That's the first part of the play before, let's just say, the magic begins. I just wanted to ask you, Dean, because I've been thinking a lot about this play, told you about this, that there's some things I'd like to talk about. And first of all, what is your impression of those four lovers? Because they're just the four lovers. I mean, what do you think of them, actually?
I mean,
think they're complex characters?
Yeah, I don't think they're necessarily, at least in what we see in the play, and it is a short play, I don't think they're overly complex, but there are some complexities. Mm. You know, we, as you say, effectively, Demetrius and Lysander are currently both in love with Hermia. And, you know, per Helena, I guess it's Helena, like Helena of Troy, she's, you know, she's got the unrequited love for Demetrius. So you're right, it is a bit complicated. You know, the waters get muddied a little bit, and you've got a kind of love square. And a blues reference, and you know, yeah, you're right that it can be complex. But these are the kind of characters I like. You know, anyone who listens to the main show and who knows my love for kind of Victorian romance, you know, this kind of ultra romance is my bread and butter when it comes to reading. This is what I really really enjoy. So I like this play, and I like those four characters a lot.
Yeah, they're great characters. I would say, though, I'm going to get back to it. I have a few thoughts, though, about a few theories about these four characters and what they're supposed to kind of represent. But basically, the story, just to continue to talk about the story, first of all. So the idea is that Lysander meets up with Hermia at midnight to escape. And Demetrius knows that Hermia will be there, so he's going to be there, too, to try and coy her back. All right. And Helena is kind of behind Demetrius, hoping that his heart
will
break.
She's tagging along. Do you get sad for her? Do you feel the pity for her that I felt?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because it's unfortunate. And it's very clear at the beginning that she's very jealous of Hermia, because Hermia, she has the love of two men, and Helena has no love, really.
But you know what's a shame? I mean, I know that you can't reduce love to mathematics, but if Demetrius looked and thought, well, there's four people and two couples, and you know, it's not like he has a shot with Hermia, because Hermia and Lysander are very much in love and it's mutual.
Yeah,
you know, and per Helena loves him, it just works. But he overcomplicates it by insisting that, you know, he wants Hermia, who he's never gonna have, and it's a shame.
Yeah, definitely, and that shows you, right? Love is not so love is the main theme of A Midsummer Night's Dream, but I think there are some many different facets of love being played here. But anyway, the story is that they meet up there. They don't meet up. It's just that they all kind of clash together. They all happen to be in the middle of this forest. And yeah, things go a bit haywire, basically, when Hermia decides to fall asleep with Lysander, because it's late, it's midnight, so they're just going to fall asleep there. And because the fairy king and the fairy queen then meet, and the fairy king is jealous. Fairy king is jealous of the fairy queen. So the name of the fairy king is
Oberon.
Exactly, thank you. And the fairy queen is Tishana, or Titania. And basically, Oberon is jealous of her because she's got an Indian changeling. So it's a kind of a ward, a kind of a beautiful child or beautiful boy. It's very unclear, actually, who he is. He never appears physically in the play. And Oberon is desperately jealous. He wants Titania to be his queen. And there's a big division in the fairy land. So it's a big division, which parallels the division that's mentioned at the beginning of the play of the Duke of Athens, Tezeos, marrying the queen of the Amazons, Hippolyta.
Now, are you aware that's Theseus, that he's an actual king of Athens, semi-mythical, so it's not really clear if he was real or not, but I'm guessing that's what Shakespeare based the character on, that semi-mythical founder, early king of Athens.
Interesting, okay. And it kind of paralleled that. But basically, Oberon is going to seek revenge. He's going to get that changeling. He wants Titania's attention by doing something mischievous. He gets his hobgoblin, Robin Puck Goodfellow, to do something for him. So basically, he has to get a magical flower that flower on someone's eyelids, that person, when that person wakes up, he or she will fall in love with the first being he or she encounters. And it's a bit of the idea is that when she wakes up, she's going to just Titania, queen of the fairies, she's just going to fall in love with whatever beast or being is there, and she's going to be made a fool of. And then Oberon is going to take that enchantment off her at some point and tell her what a fool she was and give me that Indian changeling. And anyway, the idea is that it goes haywire when, because Oberon is not such a bad fellow, he sees that there is love in the area that's not going very well. So he sees Helena being terribly upset that Demetrius is not in love with her. So there's a scene in it where Demetrius is looking for Hermia and Helena's tagging along, and Demetrius kind of says, like, kind of like, you know, why don't you go away?
He's very, you know, very like, harsh with her.
Very, very harsh with her. Yeah, he's very harsh. And then Oberon has a lot of compassion for Helena, as we do.
And poor Helena, she's just this downtrodden, unrequited romance. She resonates with me because she's similar to a lot of the Victorian characters that I'm obsessed with. But just this idea that her love isn't being requited. But she continues, despite the abuse, despite the insults, despite the clear indication that this guy thinks nothing of her and treats her like dirt. She just pursues him.
It's a bit of a 50 Shades of Grey, you know, happening here. A bit of a Wuthering Heights phenomenon.
It is sufficiently withering. It is sufficiently withering.
And basically, all right. And he tells, back to Oberon, King of the Fairies, he tells Robin Hood, Goodfellow, to put a bit of that flower enchantment on Demetrius' eyes, because Demetrius then falls asleep and Helena falls asleep. It's amazing how they just all fall asleep. Like, it's kind of like, all right, but it's a fairyland. So they just kind of like fall asleep. And however, Robin Hood, Goodfellow, now there are two theories about this. Either he's just a mischievous little git, and he's just like, he just wants a bit of fun, or he generally doesn't know who Oberon is referring with, because he sees a different man. He sees Lysandre instead of Demetrius, because Oberon says there are two Greek, there's a Greek woman and a Greek man, and the Greek man is not in love. And so when everyone's like asleep on the ground and the hobgoblin just sees Lysandre and says, all right, well, I'm going to put the dew on his eyes. And the thing is, when Lysandre wakes up, he sees Helena, not his true love Hermia, he sees Helena and then falls in love with Helena, but Helena is not in love with him.
I think this was an honest mistake. I mean, I know that Robin Goodfellow, Puck, is meant to be semi-mischievous, but it was an honest mistake to make. He'd never seen these people before, you know?
Because he just encountered, so like, obviously it's people have also said that this is a difficult play to put on stage, because basically I think the setting is supposed to be a lot bigger than you can imagine. So it's like a big forest clearing.
It's just that
Robin just encounters Lysandre first. He said he knows he's looking for a Greek band. He puts a dew on his eyes. But Lysandre then wakes up and Helena is just coming across him. He falls in love with her. And this is what I love, because then everyone is in love with someone who is in love with someone else. And that's what I love about this is when the play gets interesting.
Yes.
I love it, because just to summarize, Helena's in love with Demetrius still, but Demetrius is still in love with Hermia, but Lysandre is now not in love with Hermia. He's in love with Helena, but Hermia is in love with Lysandre.
Now, the way to fix this was to make Demetrius love Helena, but they did the opposite. They made Lysandre love Helena. So
yeah, well, it was a mistake by Robin.
Yeah. You know what? It's a little bit convenient. And again, I love the play, and I don't mean it as a criticism. It's necessary for the plot device, but the size of that forest is very convenient. It's a lot of like, now she's over here, and now he's over here, and you got the wrong one, and people are coming and going through the forest, and, you know, they show up at the right time for the story, kind of, you know, it's a bit... It's a little bit convenient at times.
It is a bit, yeah. I'd like to talk about this because I'm kind of semi-expecting some people read this, so we don't have to get on too much about the story. But I just wanted to summarize some of the story without spoiling the ending. But just to talk about some of my thoughts, and please, Dean, share with me. I just wanted to mention one thing, first of all, about the lovers. Basically, I think when I was reading The Four Lovers, I think there is also like quite a dark side to the play. I don't think it's just a lighthearted. It generally is a comedy. It's kind of a comedy, although I don't really see it like a classical Shakespeare comedy either. It's not a laugh.
Yeah, it's not pure comedy, but I guess it's a rom-com.
It's a rom-com, but do you see a dark side in the sense of I think there's something inherently wrong with the four lovers. Can you guess what it is?
No, you've caught me off guard. I took it as a simple little. I just looked at the face value and thought, here's four people, and let's see if we can get them all to love the right people. Well, so what are you seeing dark?
So I think there's something very. First of all, what I find interesting about this play is that it's quite ancient Greek style. So like an ancient Greek play often begins with a chorus, right? Where it kind of explains what happened until now.
Yeah.
And it kind of begins in the middle often. And that's unusual for nowadays. That's right. In the same sense, this play, it kind of begins in the middle. There was a whole drama. There was a whole development of falling in love. What you would have in Romeo and Juliet, for example, they meet, fall in love, and things happen. But all of that drama is not present at all. Everyone's already in love with someone. Everyone's already in pain. Everyone's trying to marry someone. It even begins with a wedding, or the beginning of the wedding of Theseus with Hippolyta. It begins in the middle, and it doesn't have a chorus. So that's one thing I like to mention about the structure.
We skip a lot of backstory. You're right.
It skips a lot of backstory. But what I'm saying, what's wrong with the four lovers is that if you think about it, first of all, we don't know their backstories at all. And these are supposed to be four individuals, all right? However, where is the individuality? They have nothing at all to back them up except their love for someone else. This is like saying, my name is Pedro. I am in love with this person and that's all I am. Like, that's it. That's just who I am. That's me. Like, there's nothing else to.
Yeah, there's nothing else to them. Now you're freaking me out a bit here. I have that feeling. You ever watch a horror movie alone at night, and then even though you know there's no spooky villain in your house, you still feel scared? That's kind of the feeling you're giving me now with the dark side of these characters. So you gotta fix this for me, dude.
Well, I can fix it for you if you want, but I think I'm just wondering how much Shakespeare. Intended to criticize weddings and love, because I get a feeling there's a very critical aspect to it. I think first of all, a lot of these characters don't make sense in what they're saying. I want to focus on the four lovers, first of all, because the way the four lovers talk to each other, the lovers, so the ones who are in love, so at least Lysander and Hermia and Helena to Demetrius, I have to say, like, often the sentences they say, it's almost a parody. It's almost a parody of, like, Romeo and Juliet. It's almost a parody of, shall I compare these
so
to
you,
a summer's
day?
You
think they're not quite real, human, in a sense?
First of all, it is called The Midsummer Night's Dream. I think there's a very important kind of psychological and even surreal aspect to it. How much true love is there, first of all, and how much... And if it's love, how healthy is it? Because basically, think about it. Hermia is leaving Athens, and she describes it as heaven. She describes it as heaven at some point, and she says, now it has become my hell. And she's actually willing to go along with Lysander's plan completely spontaneously. He just says, like, look, we're just going to leave. You're going to abandon your father. You're just going to leave your life behind, and I'm going to live in the wilderness with my aunt. God knows, you know. Who she is.
You know what? You're right. I just noticed something that's been staring me in the face the several times that I've read this play. So when I look at the dramatis personae, the list of characters, the lovers don't have anything. You know, they're not Duke of Athens. They're not Carpenter. No. They're not anything. They're just Hermia in love with Lysander. Demetrius in love with Hermia. That's their only trait, is that they are in love with someone. They don't have anything else.
But in some folios, it doesn't even say that. In some Shakespeare folios, it just says the four lovers. It just says the four names, and then it has like that. What's that? That kind of like where they put together like four names, and then together they're just four lovers, and that's all they are. And if you think about it, everyone has an identity. And so I want to mention also there is this kind of a subplot in the play, guys. For those of you who haven't read it, that's about these mechanicals. It's about these people who fix carpenters, weavers, bellows menders, tinkers, and joiners, and tailors, and they get together to form a play. And now that's, I want to get back to that because I want to get back to that in a second. Because that's a big contrast to the four lovers. The four lovers are four lovers and they have no identity. They're sacrificing whatever identity they had before because they obviously had lives and each one of them is taking a bit risk, especially Hermia and Lysandre, who are in love with each other. And Demetrius, what is Demetrius? He's just following. I mean, and they have no self-respect. They really don't.
Neither Demetrius nor Helena have really any self-respect at all.
But if you think about it, does Lysandre and Hermia have self-respect? Hermia, she's just doing this because she loves Lysandre. Lysandre's just kind of, he insults her dad as well, you know? It's like all over the place. This is just like, This is Romeo and Juliet the pirate. That's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, what do you think?
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way before, but now that you mention it, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. And I suppose when one accepts the premises, you know, logically one must accept the conclusion, you know? What you're saying makes sense.
And don't forget, there's also this is getting very dark. So guys, please don't be put off by this, but it might be an interesting reading. You can have your own opinion. Very important, though, is that the place where these four lovers meet happens to be a place where Hermia and Helena used to meet and share their bosoms, stories and thoughts and insecurities. There's a lovely picture I'm looking up now. It's in the found on Wikipedia by Washington Alston. What's his name? Washington Alston. It's a picture basically of Hermia and Helena reading a book. It doesn't appear in the play. The idea is that this painting is the idea is what they had before. The only history these four lovers have is the shared friendship of those two women. And that friendship is completely annihilated in the play. If you think about it, because when you start reading the play, they begin to hate each other, abominate each other. But we have to remember that the only thing we know about these four lovers, we know nothing about the man, and we know nothing about Hermia and Helena, except that Hermia is the daughter of, we just know she's the daughter of a man who's very important in the government, Aegeus, and that she's best friends with Helena. And we only know that Helena was best friends with Hermia. And they talk about this in the middle of the play and at the beginning, they mention it twice. They talk about their combined friendship and then the second part where they describe it, their hurt, that it's just breaking apart. And the idea is that Helena actually does something she's not completely innocent. She does something very radical. Lysandre and Hermia share something. They share with her that they're going to escape and meet up in the middle of the forest. And Helena betrays her friends. Helena betrays Hermia by telling Demetrius that Hermia will be there. Because as far as I can see, there is something vengeful there too. They're sacrificing the individuality because Helen and Hermia are not just lovers of someone or in love with someone, they're also best friends, but their friendship is thrown into the bin. And that's some dark aspects I've seen into it, but
I mean, I thought it was very interesting. You could argue that the majority of lovers in Shakespeare's canon are not what we would consider a modern healthy relationship. So I wouldn't worry massively about Lysandre and Hermia with their plan to run off. I think that I'll buy that. But Demetrius and Helena, I think they definitely are both some sad individuals, you know, both pining after someone who's interested in someone else and who's really not interested in them at all, you know.
Yeah. And they might be also like showing more like a carnal love. I feel like Demetrius and at least Demetrius, which one is true love and which one is more like a desire? Because sometimes it feels like this is very needy. They feel very needy, especially Demetrius and Helena. They feel like very needy. And the language Demetrius uses tends to be very vicious. There's something like a bit of a Freudian id kind of like escaping from him sometimes. I feel like it's often just focused on the sex, if you read between the lines, not the true love. It's like, I'm going to possess you. But then,
one thing you mentioned these other chaps, yeah. Quince the Carpenter and his band O Merry Men. I mean, did you care about these people?
I know what you're going to say. Do you want to go first? Do you care about them or not?
No, I just wanted them to go away and bring back the lovers because I wanted the story. No, don't get me wrong. I understood that there needed to be more characters than just the lovers. I was happy when we saw Theseus, the Duke of Athens. I was even happy with the fairies because they were the ones working the magic. But these guys, I just didn't see any point in them, you know. They put on their little play and it's not a very good play and they just mess around a bit and it's almost completely irrelevant to the story of the lovers. They don't intersect, really.
Now, this is what I was hoping you mentioning this because this is what I want to mention because the first time I read this, I also thought, they're poor. I mean, I love Nick Bottom. He's funny. But they seem very irrelevant. But the second time reading it, I realized that this is the counterpart of the four lovers. If the four lovers don't have identity, all right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can say I'm reading too much into this. This is just an interpretation. What is the point of this subplot of these mechanical engineers engineering specialists getting together and forming play? It seems completely irrelevant. And maybe story-wise, it is completely irrelevant. But if you think about it, there are two things about these people. First of all, they are working-class people striving to perform arts. That's one thing. So they're actually working class people who are making themselves become actors. They're creating a new identity. Second of all, they fix things. They all have something in common, and that's that they fix things. Each one of them fixes and constructs something, which makes me think that these people have a complex identity, even though they seem completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter what they're saying. It's not relevant. But if you think about it, because they're very relevant. They're very, very relevant to play. They are because structurally they are because they appear right at the end of the play after the main plot is finished. Guys, I'm not going to spoil it. But just so you know, it seems like very irrelevant because the main plot is finished and then these guys perform their play.
And it's kind of boring.
It's a bit boring. It is a bit boring. But that makes me think, what was Shakespeare's point? I think Shakespeare is trying to say something here. I think Shakespeare is trying to like highlight. I think he's trying to say he's kind of like annoyed at over romantic young people.
You think he's trying to bring us back to like a harsh reality after the kind of airy, fairy, dreamy romance that we've had with these unrealistic lovers?
I think more like the second part. I think unrealistic lovers versus the everyday person that lived in Shakespeare's life that was poor trying to create art. And you had, but the thing is very important that Lysander and Demetrius at the end and Theseus, they're all men. I think there's also a bit of a feminist trait going on in the play I want to talk about. But these men, they're very superficial, by the way, because I don't know anything about these three men. They seem very, Hermia and Helena seem deeper to me. But these three men, they just joke about the play the whole time. And they say it's so hammy. It was interesting because these guys actually made a huge effort to create something in the forest. And I think it's very important. I think Shakespeare's trying to actually say that I think Shakespeare himself has more compassion for these working men than the four lovers, even though it might not seem that way the first time.
But they overestimate themselves. They make their own play worse by explaining everything they're doing because they're afraid that the play will be too good and that like the lion will genuinely scare the ladies, and you know, so they then explain, I'm just a person in a lion costume, you know, and they explain everything like over and they ruin their own play by breaking the fourth wall just constantly because they don't want anyone to think that it's real.
I think also possibly it's also a bit like Shakespeare's also making fun of the theater he saw on that day, because he probably saw some really crap theater that was like that. I think he's also messing about there. It's complex. I think like he's also just like he's referring maybe to a lot of people he saw on the theater acting out like this. But I think there's also an aspect of they really are forming their own identities. They have several identities. Each one of them has several identities. And Nick Bottom, I want to talk about Nick Bottom because Nick Bottom is a weaver. And so, guys, it's not much of a spoiler. You've all seen the donkey's head. He gets a donkey's head by Robin Puck Goodfellow. And Titiana falls in love with Nick Bottom, with the donkey's head. And the crew, they run away because they think he's a monster. He's the thou has been transposed or something. And they run away, and Titiana wakes up with the dew on her eyes, and she sees Nick Bottom, who's got an ass's head. So it's very kind of clear what. And yeah, and it's just that's like most people see it as comic relief, but he's my favorite character, Nick Bottom. Honestly, he's my favorite character. I mean, what do you think of that whole kind of she's falling in love with the ass scene and the way he behaves?
I mean, I suppose I just saw it as the comic relief almost, you know, because in a sense, there's three loosely related storylines here. There's the lover storyline, which was the one that I cared about. There's the joiners and the carpenters and so on that I didn't really care about. And then there's this third story with Oberon and Titania and their kind of story with the fairies. And yes, they enter into the story of the lovers a little bit, but as you say, they do have their own separate thing with making Bottom the donkey and making Titania fall in love with him. And they're just kind of messing around in their own little subplot, their own little Gaiden. And for me, that was just the comic relief almost. That was just, you know, well, we've got some comedy in here. It is meant to be a lighthearted play, and that's fine. You know, if you're gonna use the magic on the lovers, then why not use it on the fairy queen as well and make her fall in love with the donkey? Like, why not? You know,
definitely, dear listeners. Despite my more kind of dark kind of theories, this play was actually made for someone's wedding, so it is supposed to be a wedding play, and literally the wedding march you hear no, that's not, sorry. Actually, did the wrong wedding march. It's not that one. It's the, how's it going again?
I think they're the same song. You mean the one that goes, I think they're the same song.
Oh, I don't know. Are they the same song? Anyway, that's the wedding march.
I think one's the intro for the other. Yeah.
Okay, fine. So anyway, so that's bit of comic relief for you guys.
You're right. They're not. They're different.
No, they're two different wedding marches. Anyway, one of the wedding marches,
sorry, PJ, I haven't been married enough times. I'm lacking.
Yeah, you haven't been married enough times. So there you go. So basically, it's Felix Mendelssohn's wedding march, and it comes from Felix Mendelssohn in 1842. Did A Midsummer Night's Dream, like incidental music to the play. So you can actually listen up on YouTube. I was just recommending it to Dean because I was listening to it earlier. I didn't know it. It's very enjoyable. It kind of brings the atmosphere, the very joyous atmosphere, because it is a joyful play, and you can really hear it. And it's like very, it's kind of very exciting. So I recommend that, Felix Mendelssohn. And my point is, this is a wedding play. This is lighthearted. But that's a thing. I think Shakespeare is making a lot of fun out of these four lovers. They're supposed to be a bit, for me, they're supposed to be a bit ridiculous, a bit, even though I also feel for them. I do. And Nick Bottom, I love this.
It has that nice, you know, yes, it's essentially a rom-com, but you're right. I mean, obviously it's A Midsummer Night's Dream. It has a very dreamish quality to it, and not just the specific scenes where the lovers are under the spell and they fall in love with the wrong people, you know, not just that, but I think the whole thing, it has a very dreamish quality. And when you finish it, you do feel that you've woken up from a kind of spell. It's an intriguing and very, very captivating play. I think it's something quite special among Shakespeare's works.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, people often say that it's a very lyrical play, and that it's sometimes better just to read the play rather than how it performed, because it's just such a dreamlike quality. It's more in the head. I don't know about that. I haven't seen it performed actually, but just I feel the same. So when you read it, guys, it does feel like a dream. It's very enjoyable.
I've read all of Shakespeare's plays, but I've never seen a full performance because they're always 3.5 hours long, and I just can't do it. It's too long.
I enjoy reading them, so we don't really have too much experience, Dean and I, watching Shakespeare. Now, what can I say about this one? I think it does have dark themes. I do think that, but it's like it's very enjoyable because the first reading is just completely enjoyable. But I think if you think about it, you get to see this. I want to mention Nick Bottom. So Nick Bottom is a weaver. He's ridiculous. He's usually portrayed by a ham actor. By the way, ham actor, which comes from Hamlet. So it's like so ham to be hamish, to be a ham actor is actually to be acting out Hamlet, which we'll talk about as well. Anyway, but Nick Bottom is, I think, a very intriguing character. I don't know if you agree, Dean. Do you think he's just a bit of a he's a bit of an ass? Wink, wink. Do you think that, Dean, or do you
He's a
think
bit of
he's
an
very
ass, I
intriguing?
guess. Yeah,
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, he has that the bottom and the ass joke isn't the only time these chaps' names are. So the bellows mender's name is Flute, and the joiner's name is Snug, like a kind of snug joint. There's a lot of that going on. I mean, it's interesting
Playing
that you
words,
pick
yeah.
Bottom out specifically among the others. I mean, obviously, yes, he's the one that gets chosen for the donkey scene, but. But apart from that, I mean, what makes you think that he's special?
This is a theory I have, which might not be Shakespeare's intention, though. I have a feeling Shakespeare had some ideas about the four lovers. I think Nick Bottom is a very sort of interesting character for today's world, but I'm not sure if for Shakespeare because of the value system. So the values have changed. And nowadays, back in Shakespeare time and even ancient Greek times, so we have to think about both times, someone who had over self-esteem, overconfidence, and over-optimism, which are Nick Bottom's main trait. He's very over the top. He's very completely confident of himself. He knows what he's doing. He's the man. I'm going to do this way. But I think those are traits that are very relevant. I think being overconfident, what's to say overconfident? To have like a lot of confidence, I want to say, to have a lot of confidence, to have a lot of optimism. And he is very much a hands-on person. He does now he directs maybe badly sometimes the play. He gives too many recommendations. But all in all, he's a very sort of kind of proactive, of course, egotistical, yeah, sure. But I think it's the kind of character traits, even though it might be over the top, that we could maybe learn from. I feel like I could learn from Nick Bottom. I would like to have some of Nick Bottom's traits. And when I
You'd
see the
like to
four
have the
lovers,
overconfidence.
yeah, I'd like to have the enough confidence that he has because he basically just he gets everything done. The thing is, at the end of the play, at the wedding, there are several play troupes, theatrical troupes that can play. And the king, the Duke of Athens chooses one, and he chooses Nick Bottom's one. The idea is, I think that Nick Bottom, he gets rewards. Nick Bottom always gets rewards. The Queen of the Fairy falls in love with him, and she treats him like a god. And he also gets picked by the Duke of Athens to act out in his play. The Nick Bottom is the luckiest Shakespeare character ever. But why is he the luckiest Shakespeare character ever? Perhaps because he's quite unaware and of like he's quite unaware of misfortune. He only sees luck. He sees the glass is always full. And this might be a
But
good trait.
am I remembering this wrong? Because my understanding was that Quince, the carpenter, was the one who actually organized the play. He was kind of in charge of Bottom and the others.
Yeah. But Nick Bottom's always interfering. He always knows better. There is a bit of a Donald Trump aspect in Nick Bottom, which I don't like. You see, that's the there again. There's a bit of a you can have too much. You can have a kind of a Donald Trump kind of like I know better. I'm going to direct this. Yeah, we're gonna do this. You know what I mean? Just like that. But I mean, there's also this sense of like, no, I'm just going to like a Dr. Wayne Dyer. I'm going to law. Just be positive. Just do your thing.
Well,
Just it's always good.
Aristotelian virtue ethics kind of imply that, on any kind of given trait, there's a way to go too much and a way to go too little, and you want to be
Yeah,
right in the middle. Even with something as
exactly.
simple as courage, you don't want to be so courageous that you're foolhardy and you run out and get killed.
Exactly.
Everything you want to find the kind of happy medium.
Exactly. Yeah, and Nick Bottom, but Nick Bottom might be. It might be over the top, but Nick Bottom is kind of like there's something also very Nietzschean about him. There's something like a bit of a Nietzschean child. He just does what he wants to. He's not angered. He's not frustrated like the lovers, because everyone is angered. Like all the kings, the king of the fairies, Duke of Athens, angered. The lovers, they're frustrated. You know, Titania is kind of like both the queen of the Amazons and the queens of the fairies are kind of repressed, and they also feel this frustration.
Yeah. But my interpretation was slightly different. I kind of thought that these workers weren't kind of capable of the kind of high class feeling that the lovers had.
Perhaps, maybe, but you can see it one or the other way, and they might just be comic relief in the end. So they might be reading in too much.
You bring up something I wanted to ask you: Hippolyta, Queen of the Amazons. What is her purpose in this play? I couldn't really see why she's there.
So the Queen of the Amazons, if you look at it historically, Queen of the Amazons, because I want to talk about the feminist aspect of this, and it's not very clear at first either, because it seems like a sexist play at first, actually. The love of man who controlled the woman, and they also, the woman don't really win at the end. They do, nothing really changes. But the Queen of the Amazons, basically, they're warriors. They're woman warriors, you know. There were women warriors who just got men to make them pregnant, then tell them to F off. And then they raised the child. And if it was a son, they also sent it off to the dad. They're really radical feminists, you could say, in today's modern sense. Hippolyta, her role, Hippolyta, is the same as Titania's. So these are parallel universes, basically. Oberon, Theseus, Hippolyta in the real world, Greek world. Oberon, Titania in the fairy world. I think Hippolyta is a repressed woman. She's never content in the play. So if you read into it, guys, Hippolyta's phrases are never sweet or gentle. They're always kind of like, they're a bit kind of frustrated, angry even.
But I think would say Hippolyta, that she doesn't really have that many phrases. I mean, my understanding of her was that she didn't... I think if you leave her out of the play, nothing changes.
Because she... No, but that's the thing, because, of course... Nothing changes, but she is the queen of the Amazons. Why did Shakespeare choose that particular person? Because it's like saying the absolute ultimate radical feminist. I think he's saying something there. And Theseus also tries to repress Hermia. She tells Hermia to stick with her dad. And Theseus, the Duke of Athens, he tries to control all the women. A bit like the play we like, Lysistrata by Aristophanes. There's a theme of like men really desperately trying to repress the woman. Hippolyta should have more to say because she's the queen of the Amazons, but yet she's so repressed that she's lost her identity as well. And this is, again, identity loss. She used to be the queen of the Amazons. Now she's just the Duke of Athens' wife. That's it. So again, another identity loss. That's what I'm talking about, the identities here.
Is she married to Theseus? I wasn't clear on that, or she was just hanging around with him as a kind of guest at court. I'm not clear on that, actually.
You know, she's kind of forced to marry him. Yeah, so it's like the whole play takes place during their wedding, which takes a few days actually. And at the end, the wedding is complete, and she doesn't have anything to say anymore. This is very, very dark, actually. Again, there's a very dark aspect because it's like you're just taking a woman and just eliminating her identity. And but I think there's also a feminist aspect here of like, they're all very feminine. Hippolyta, queen of the Amazons, and then Titania, queen of the fairies. Hippolyta is already being, she didn't, that's very important actually. I don't know if you noticed, but Hippolyta didn't mean to marry Theseus. She was kind of forced to it. And Titania, queen of the fairies, doesn't want to marry Oberon. So she hasn't married. I'm not sure if she, maybe she's married him. No, I don't think they're married. The idea is, I think both of these women don't want this, but like the men are really forcing them and doing devious tricks. So Theseus, Duke of Athens, might have done political tricks and like killed, or I don't know, killed Hippolyta's, I don't know, armies. And Oberon's doing the same thing. It's all about, the play is very much about men trying to conquer women and suppress them. It is. And it's the same with Lysander and Demetrius. Completely superficial man, in my opinion. I know nothing about Lysander and Demetrius. They just want... Why are they so desperate to be with Hermia and Helena?
Yeah, we know nothing else about them.
And that's what I find interesting about the player, right?
I think with that thought, PJ, I think we've come full circle. Do you think that we should leave it there?
Yeah, we can leave it there. I just want to say to you guys that really recommend the play. And I just recommend that you read it a second time as well. See if you agree with us. But I think basically you can also just read it lightheartedly. But I think it just has a lot of interesting political and general and identity themes in it. But all in all, it's a very lighthearted play. And I hope you can enjoy it. So have fun.
Cool. Well, I think that'll do us. Guys, check us out, booksboys.com, where you can find all the different links to our other projects and all the different places to follow us and tell your friends. And that's us.
All right, guys. See ya.
Welcome to the second episode of Playboys. We're going to talk about some plays. How are you, PJ?
I'm doing great. How are you, Dean?
I'm grand. I'm really, really loving getting back into Shakespeare.
I know, me too. It's fantastic. I'm really digging it, yeah.
Do you know what I'm loving? I'm loving being able to pick a play together and read it and talk about it. It's nice because the way I did Shakespeare last time was... I just started at the beginning and worked all my way through nonstop in order. But most of the first plays were all the kings and especially the Henrys. And the worn out after those that I didn't enjoy the other ones as much as I could have done. So this is much better.
Yeah, and it's great to just have someone to talk with because you just, not to be having to rush through it and stuff. I'm enjoying it, doing it with you as well. And just getting to it. And some of these I haven't read before. I didn't read all the Shakespeare plays like you, so it's very fresh.
We can't all be as pompous as I am, you know, to point out to everyone on a regular basis that I've read the complete works of Plato, Shakespeare, and Dickens, you know.
just like hi, my name is Dean. By the way, I've read everything Charles Dickens ever wrote and Plato and Shakespeare, so therefore thou must like me. That's basically your opening line. I know, yeah.
Well, why don't you tell the secret? Which play are we talking about today?
We're talking about the fabulous, the one and only, The Tempest.
Ooh. We did hint at that last time, so I don't know how big a secret that is, but
well, I suppose so, yeah. But the reason why I chose this one, so we're kind of choosing them together, but some of them are more mine choice, some of them are more Dean's choice. Now, these first two are more mine choice, I think, right? So Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest. And the reason I chose those two first, as I mentioned before, is that they're the only ones from Shakespeare where there is a fantasy involved, except perhaps Macbeth and the witch scene. That's a very minor scene. Just in general, magic is not present in Shakespeare. And I thought we could talk about these. Now, The Tempest came later, so The Tempest is a later
play. It's one of his last plays, if I remember correctly. It's a very late period play for
people. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And anyway, we'll talk about it. Do you want to tell the synopsis, or should I, Dean?
Who wants to go? Work away.
So The Tempest is basically it's about a storm, I suppose. It starts off in the Mediterranean. And it's basically the king's ship. The king is called Alonso. He's the king of Naples or Napoli. And he's in a ship that's just basically, it's the end, basically. They're all going to die. And that's the way it looks. They're all going to die. It's a tempest and there's nothing they can do. And everyone's jumping off the ship. It's all very dramatic. But yes, everyone jumps off the ship or falls unconscious. But actually, no one dies. Not a single person. They all end up ashore, safe and sound, with their garments intact.
And, not only intact, but in better condition than hitherto.
Well, quote, not a hair perished, or their sustaining garments not a blemished. Sorry, I'll say that again. Quote, Not a hair perished, or their sustaining garments not a blemish, but fresher than before. Indeed. And why is this? It's because Prospero, the former Duke of Milan, has learned a bit of magic. He's been stuck on that island for years with his daughter Miranda, and he's been stuck there because his brother was not, he didn't like his older brother being the Duke, Antonio. So Antonio didn't like Prospero being the Duke, and instead of killing him, though, because he thought that would make him unpopular and the king, so the king conspired with him, they sent off Prospero and his daughter Miranda to a cease, basically, and hoping they just die, you know. And then, you know, it's kind of an interesting moral dilemma, right? It's kind of like saying, oh, I didn't kill anyone, you know. I had to just sort of bless them. They just sort of died there, you know. I should have just meant to send them on a cruise, you know. It's a kind of very anyway. And they end up on an island. He raises Miranda, who's basically never been in civilization. It's basically him taking advantage of the king of Naples, Alonso, and his own brother, Antonio, being on a ship nearby, and he sends a tempest and his sort of attendant spirit. He has a spirit called Ario. And together they manage to form a tempest that brings the boats to the island with a scheme in mind. I don't want to say too much to why he does it. Now, that's what I like about the tempest is that we're not 100% sure what Prospero is planning, but there's a whole plan that goes from beginning to the right to the end. And he's just trying to accomplish several things, which needs a lot of timing. It's very much about timing, Tempest, and about, he's kind of like a puppet master, I suppose. Prospero is, isn't he?
I mean, it's helped by the fact that he has obviously Ariel, who, you know, is a spirit, can bring about the situations that he wants, can influence events and people. So, you know, that helps him in his sort of puppet mastery.
Exactly, and it's kind of a Deus Ex Machina device, isn't it? Like having Ariel there, because it's kind of. Just he can Shakespeare with Ariel can kind of do anything, and everything is kind of okay. And I mean, extraordinary things happen, but it's okay because he's a magician, Prospero, and Ariel is like a spirit that can just do anything, in fact, just anything. So it's kind of it makes everything very believable. And he sort of gets away with murder, doesn't he, Shakespeare? Because the logic is just thrown out the window, isn't it? With the Tempest,
yes, but it's. It's actually nice. It's refreshing a little bit to see you know, because as you say, it is rare. I mean, I know it doesn't seem rare because we just did Midsummer Night's Dream, but then you've got a whole load of other plays with no fantastical elements. So it is It is refreshing to have that extra license to play around a little bit more with your story.
Exactly. Yeah. So what were your thoughts about the Tempest? So, I mean, we continue the story in a second, but I mean, that's just the beginning, basically. I mean, what do you think of the character Prospero to begin with? So the main character, arguably, of the play.
Yeah, no, I would say the main character is a fair point. Yeah. I felt for Prospero because at the end of the day, he is the rightful Duke of Milan. And, you know, he's, as you say, he's been essentially exiled and he is a strong character. It's not really explained, you know, in detail how he, it's referenced once, I think, but you know, how he comes to have these abilities, you know, how he has Ariel. But not in a lot of detail. I think it is mentioned once, but I liked him actually. I saw him as the hero of the piece, really. I thought that he deserved his position back.
He deserved his position back, didn't he? And, I thought he's quite a complex character because he's not 100%. You can't say he's a good kind of person either because he does borderline kind of mean things as well. I feel like he's not nice to his slave, Caliban. And I want to get back to this in a second. I think he's a fascinating character. But basically, one subplot is that Miranda and Prosper were not alone on the islands. There was a witch. Basically, there was outcast. Called Sycorax or Sycorax, and she also had a son, kind of like just like kind of a monster son, they call him, called Caliban or
Caliban.
Yeah, Caliban. Yeah, and Prosper and Miranda don't treat Caliban at all well. Like they don't. Shocking.
It's more shocking to see that from Miranda, you know, because Prospero, yeah, he is that strong character, and as you say, sometimes he's not even always nice to Ariel, really. But it's a bit more surprising seeing Miranda also be quite cruel with Caliban,
like really cruel with Caliban. I think that's very interesting. I think perspectives have changed, though, you know, because this was written between 1610 and 1611, so over 400 years ago. And I think it's very interesting that the Tempest at that time, it was kind of perhaps okay because they thought it was okay to treat savages like this. They call them savages, but it just makes me think of colonialism. I think it's very interesting to see that nowadays I don't feel the Tempest is that popular because it's got that inherent racism in it that Prospero and Miranda have. Caliban is a monster. He's not a monster. He's a human being, but he's described as a savage monster, deformed. And it makes me think, the Tempest makes me think a lot about America and about colonialism. And I'm just wondering, though, how conscious was Shakespeare about it, criticizing it, or did he just take it as this was okay? It was okay to maltreat American savages, you know. And this is obviously hugely controversial nowadays, but I'm wondering how okay was it back in Shakespeare's times, you know.
And early 17th century, I would say it was fairly run of the mill, you know. I don't think that anyone seeing this play performed at the time would have been outraged by the treatment of Caliban. I think they would have taken it as normal.
Perhaps not, no, but I feel like Caliban is the person I relate with the most. Because you have to understand, people, that Caliban, there's a shocking scene in it where Prospero says, it's basically understood that Caliban actually tried to rape Miranda at one point earlier in the story. It's a very minor detail. And and he said, because he says that, I could have peopled the island with Calibans had you not stopped me. Yeah, so it's like Caliban is not a good character, but he's kind of like a victim character. He is a victim. He's a product of his environment, isn't he? He's a product of the mean environment he's been. And how did his mom die? That's not even that clear.
We didn't stress this before, but his mom, the sort of witchy character, does not appear in the play. You know, she does not appear in the play at all.
She just kind of died, you know, like. And it's Caliban at the beginning. He does say like, thou hast treated me well. Thou hast taught me all kinds of things to Prospero. So Prospero was a father figure at the beginning. But then he says, but that was at the beginning. And then you took my island away from me. I'm really the king. So Caliban thinks he's the king of this island. And he's very bitter about me. And even says to Miranda, he says, which I find interesting, he says, you taught me language and my profit on it is I know now how to curse. So it's a bit like, even language, like even he's learned English, well, Italian, I suppose, really, in that time. But like, he's not grateful. He's like, they've taken something away. They forced some kind of what he sees as sick culture, like sick white culture upon his native culture. That just reminds me all about colonialism, about American people having to learn Spanish, but what happened to their, or English, what happened to their real culture? So again, I'm sorry, I think I'm getting very dark again, just like with Midsommar. I don't know why I'm reading all this darkness into Shakespeare lately.
But enough about that. Very superficially. But it's interesting that you find more empathy for Caliban. Don't get me wrong, the way they treat him is quite mean, particularly in the early acts of the play.
Yeah.
And I did have some sympathy for him, of course. But at the same time, as soon as they say, you know, well, we used to treat you, you know, he complains about his treatment, and they say, we used to treat you well until you tried to rape my daughter. That kind of, they lost me at that point. You know, the empathy just dissipated immediately for me at that point, you know.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it's just like any kind of criminal, right? I mean, you lose empathy, but at the same time, there's a reason why they became this way. What did you find particularly interesting about The Tempest or the characters? Because that's my main highlight. Caliban is, and Prospero, really interested in those characters.
Mm-hmm. I felt for Miranda, because I felt that she had obviously, daughter, she was a sweet girl. She had tried to bring on Caliban to improve him, to give him that language, that education, only to actually almost get too close to him and you know, almost get assaulted sexually by him. And I felt for her, actually. But then, I mean, do we want to get enough into the plot to mention some of the things that happened later with Miranda, how you think?
Well, I think we could mention, guys, there's minor spoiler, so you can just you can just not listen for a second. But basically, please do listen. Actually, basically,
please Miranda... listen. Yeah, can we stress on the general rule of the podcast? Please listen.
Yeah, please listen, guys. Don't turn off your radios or phones or whatever.
Don't turn down that dial.
It's Shakespeare, so there's got to be some love plot in there, right? Do you want to say what happens with Miranda?
Yeah, it's the love plot. It's the love guy down that is necessary in every play. In my opinion, in every thing, we always need this, you know. And of course, she falls in love with Ferdinand, who is actually the son of Alonso, the king of Naples. So. That's an interesting, unexpected kind of twist that'll bring the characters together later. But it's one of those things where he's, apart from Caliban, you know, Ferdinand is basically the only person she's really seen in years apart from her father. And she immediately falls in love with him. Immediately. Love at first sight. And her father literally says, like, he's not that great. He's just the only guy you've met. Be aware, he's the only guy you've ever met.
He actually says, I think he says he is a Caliban to most other men or something like
that. Yes, he says he's probably a Caliban to most other men.
So Caliban is getting a lot of grief, I'm afraid. But yeah, that is, but actually that's the genius of Shakespeare, because you might think like, oh, what a coincidence, the prince. But no, wait, that's the point. Prospero is a magician. He's obviously a master plan. This was Ariel. That's the son. Ferdinand is alone. He's on a different part of the island, while the others are on are all together. Not so they're like three or four different groups, and just Ferdinand's on his own, and Ariel's guiding him to beautiful Miranda, and this is all masterminded, you know. So it's all, but it's great because Shakespeare is kind of like with Prospero and Ariel. He can do anything he wants, and he gets away with it. You don't have to think about logic. That's what I love about. Tempest.
There's an interesting juxtaposition here, because what I really enjoyed was we are seeing that Prospero has masterminded most of the elements of the main plot, but at the same time, he's not in full control, because he didn't particularly want Miranda to fall in love with Ferdinand, not knowing who Ferdinand was, of course, at that time. But at the same time, then we have this other story with when Caliban meets Trinculo and Stefano, jester and the drunken butler. And that's a more crazy, wilder story, you know, it's outside of that realm of control of Prospero.
Mm-hmm. I find that very interesting. I love that small subplot. I think Stefano is a very Nick Bottom kind of character. I mean, I feel he is the Nick Bottom of the Tempest. Guys, so you enjoy that. It reminds me of the whole actors kind of getting together in Forrest parts, Nick Bottom parts. It's kind of like comic relief. But again, just like with Nick Bottom in the previous episode I mentioned, I think Stefano, Trinculo, Caliban, that scene is a very sort of social critique again. It's basically kind of the nouveau riche, I think. It's basically the upper class getting power and wanting to become kings, yet they're still basically the average jack. I think Shakespeare's kind of playing about was, yeah, the new rich, but they're still like, they might not be suited for this part yet. I mean, they're drunkards, basically, they're alcoholics. And it's a very funny scene, though. I don't want to say anything more, actually, because it's actually a great scene. Yeah, no.
And I can't actually remember if it's Trunculo or Stefano, but one of them decides that he's going to be king of the island, right?
Exactly. Stefano will become king of the island, because Caliban has respect for Stefano. So only because Stefano brings alcohol. And that's very interesting.
Yeah.
you see, the whole social critique in it, there's another colonialist social critique was is basically alcohol and tobacco and drugs destroyed all kinds of nations across the world. I mean, you've got the opium wars in China, you've got Native Americans becoming addicted to tobacco. And that's a very interesting fact that alcohol is now in Caliban's life, you know, the native of the island. Again, my dark reading of Shakespeare. But there you go. I just find you can. I feel like you can just read anything out of anything, can't you? I mean, I could probably have a piece of toast.
So what's really interesting, dude, is that whether or not Shakespeare intended that reading is almost irrelevant. The fact that it's so relatable that you can read into things that happened at that time or even have modern comparisons says a lot about human nature, almost apart from the author's intention, you know.
Totally. And guys, that's why we're doing Shakespeare, because Shakespeare was, by the way, not necessarily revered for a long time. A lot of classicists at the time didn't like him because he didn't follow the Aristotelian laws of theater. They preferred Christoph Marlowe, I believe, and Ben Jonson at the time. And Shakespeare has become more popular after Romanticism, and especially his modernist literature. It becomes more relevant as time goes. And I find reading Shakespeare, almost all of his plays are really, really modern. They could have been written yesterday, I find Macbeth a really modern tale, or even a Tempest for post-colonialist kind of readings. Different, and they're always different themes, so it's great.
Yeah, the only thing is, I suppose, for someone that's not read them before, you have that initial barrier of the slightly older language.
Yeah.
But once you get past that, as you say, the actual story could have been written yesterday, you know.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's quite amazing, actually, I think. Wow, yeah. And it's a very quotable play. I was just mentioning to Dean earlier, I think. It's got some great...
You want to give us the big one?
Should I give us the big one? All right, guys. For any dystopian fiction fans, here we go. So Miranda, you know, she hasn't seen that many men before, so it's maybe not surprising. And all right, so she goes, but then she sees all of a sudden a lot of men, and they're just normal men. But she goes, "Oh wonder, how many goodly creatures are there here? How bounteous mankind is! Oh brave new world that has such people in it."
Oh, brave new world. There we go. To be fair, that was opening up something of a new world for her. You know, it was a big change to her life. And of course, she immediately, you know, requires marriage because that was just not how it was done. But yeah, that's the big one, because that's where we got the title of the famous dystopian novel by Aldous Huxley, Brave New World.
Exactly. And don't forget, Brave New World has a character in it, basically called Savage. And it does make a lot of references, because this guy grew up outside the modern world. It's completely, Brave New World is very, if you properly understand Brave New Worlds, you should read The Tempest, actually, and understand the characters of both Caliban and Miranda, because essentially Miranda is a savage. That's an interesting thing. She's a Victorian savage. It's a very interesting mix, kind of, you know. So I love it. Yeah, it's great reading. What can I say? I also love the phrase Prospero says to Ferdinand at one point. I love the phrase because I was feeling weak at the beginning of this week, and I thought, oh God, it was actually a bit daunting. And this phrase, I just read it the other day, and I thought, wow, this really relates to how I felt. It's, "Come on, obey. Thy nerves are in their infancy now, and have no vigor in them." He basically put a spell on Ferdinand that he can't move at all. And I thought that phrase, "thy nerves are in their infancy," again, that's a very dark phrase for this post-COVID, or not really post, is it? This COVID world, "thy nerves are in their infancy now." Very scary phrase.
There's this one little moment that I really like, and it is later in the play, so it might be sort of a spoiler, but it's not a key moment really. But it's when Alonso is, you know, he's fearing for his men. He finds some of them, but he's fearing for his son Ferdinand.
The king of Naples is worrying for
it. And so, he's saying, you know, he's worried about Ferdinand. And then, you know, he basically just finds him playing chess and hanging out with Miranda. But he's worried, you know, that it's going to be, what has happened to him? You know, what have you done with him? Oh, no, he's just there, you know, just chilling out, just playing chess, you know.
Yeah, that's actually that's
in
great.
The, in
that's
the
great.
cave or the you know cell, it's described as you know.
It's great, right? I love it. Yeah. I suppose we better wrap up, right?
I think so. Yeah. Though,
I just want to. Can I just quote one more thing of the
one
Tempest?
One more. Let's have it.
Okay. So this reminds me of Trump. So this is a bit mad, but this is a great phrase for all you. Yeah, for our people. Miranda says about Prospero and his mean brother, because Prospero is saying, like, mark his condition and the event, then tell me if this might be a brother. And Miranda says, I should sin to think but nobly of my grandmother. Good wombs have borne bad sons. Wow, and I love that phrase because it's just a bit of a... I just thought of Trump's mother when I read that. Don't know why I gained this strange reading from, but I just thought, like, yeah, no, every villain out there has a mother. Just remember that, guys. So let's just respect our mothers. And it's just an interesting philosophical perspective. I have to say, I think Miranda's quite a... she's got a lot of kind of Victorian traits, as you say, but I think she's quite a strong female character, nevertheless. Interesting perspective she has. So anyway, that's enough about me. Ranting on about.
I think she's probably my favorite character in it. To be fair, Miranda.
I think she's very strong. Because you see, sometimes the female characters are not quite as strong as I would hope them to be in Shakespeare. And I think she's interesting in the sense that she grew up isolated, reared by an eccentric dad, and she has interesting thoughts. Like, yeah, has quite a strong voice, I find. Yeah.
Well, I think we'll leave it there. Don't forget, anyone who's listening to this on our free preview, that this is going to be a lot more of this kind of content available soon at a premium. And if you're already listening in the future, then hopefully you're enjoying this and more to come. Don't forget, of course, you can get in touch with us about any of our content at booksboys@hotmail.com. And the only thing I wanted to say, because I didn't mention it last time, and I don't want to mention it every time we do this, but just thank you to Trapdoor, and in particularly Wiggly, for our intro music that we've been using on the Playboys.
Thanks, guys. It's awesome.
That's a little clip from a song called Aztec versus Aztown from their 50 years of Trapdoor album, which you can also find in iTunes. I think that's
awesome. Well, guys,
take care, and we're not gonna. Shall we reveal the next one, or should it be a surprise?
I suppose. Do you want to reveal? This is your choice, so you can go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. The next one was my choice. It's one of my favorites. I just reread it today and remembered why it was one of my favorites. It's The Comedy of Errors. So there we go.
It's a great one, guys. So tune in for that one. Quite different to The Tempest, but just as equally, you know, genius writing. So it's great stuff.
Guys, patreon.com/booksboys. Please sign up. At the lowest tier, you'll be able to get yourself some bonus content. We're going to have all the Bufanda boys. The Playboys are on there. There's going to be some Agatha Christie content coming soon as well. I might throw up a few old musician interviews from the archives that I've done. There'll be plenty of bonus content on there for you. And as well as that, of course, at higher tiers, you can also tell us what books to read on the main show. And get yourself a Books Boys t-shirt as well. So plenty of goodies there for you. And of course, it really, really, really helps to support the show. And it means that we can devote more time to it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.